a few days on the front end, a few days on the back end. That is a really good time. You find a good scrape.
You give away all your secrets?
I'm pretty transparent. But
we all went to high school with that guy that could go out and you know, he'd just stand there and all the girls would flock to him.
Yeah. And what's crazy is everybody has different effects after lime.
For Pennsylvania hunters and conservationists, our roots run deep. The episodes we bring to you on the Pennsylvania Game Commission's podcast, Call of the Outdoors, will take a deep dive into exposing the incredible work being done by agency staff and partners, including statewide habitat projects, the science behind wildlife management, and what drives agency decisions. The Pennsylvania Game Commission's mission is twofold: to manage and protect wildlife and their habitats for not only current but future generations, and to promote hunting and trapping in the Keystone State.
Well, good morning, Bo. Thanks for joining us today here at TAC. I mean, lots going on, and we surely appreciate you joining us here on the podcast.
Yeah, no, thanks. It's beautiful weather. Nice, not too hot.
It's crazy that, you know, we're winding turkey season down, and it's like Long John weather in the daylight. It was 39 degrees this morning. It's nuts. Somebody said they saw a buck rutting a doe, you know, earlier this morning, but, you know, that's what happens when you get to TAC or, you know, like really this kicks off hunting season for a lot of people, and
yeah,
people are fired up.
I know for me, it's always it's kind of the kick in the butt that I need to humble myself when I go shoot on the course and be like, okay, I got some things
to
work
ready.
On.
Yeah.
I got some things to work on.
And we want
to
talk a lot about that. And, you know, first of all, like, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're from and what's going on for the folks out there that from our agency that don't know. But I mean, obviously you've been really busy the last few years.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm from Pennsylvania. I've been a Pennsylvania native my entire life and grew up in northern Pennsylvania, so very just big timber, big woods, not any ag, and that's just how I've learned to deer, turkey hunt, everything else, and my whole family is huge into hunting, and so I really didn't have a choice. Like that was the path kind of I was going down, and I had started the East Meets West Hunt podcast about 6 years ago. Oh yeah, 6 years ago at this event.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Was the first podcast I recorded, and it was originally directed at me wanting to learn how to do better Western hunting and the East meets West.
Right.
And then I came to realize a little bit, and I started talking about hunting in Pennsylvania and hunting some of these big woods areas that I've grown up doing my whole life. I didn't think anybody was interested in that, and I found, you know, well, Pennsylvania, we have a lot of people that like to hunt, and a lot of people that could relate to it, and that's been kind of the direction and the focus that it's been, and especially in the last few years, and really going down that side of things. And
you give away all your secrets?
I'm pretty transparent, but
go.
I also I do not like to give any specifics,
right,
on locations. Areas. Anytime I do any map tutorials, they are on areas that I am not hunting, and they are not public land to try to protect places.
When I was a kid, like the old timers, somebody'd ask them about a turkey, and they'd send them to a wild goat, or, you know, wild goose chase, because there wasn't any turkeys where they sent them. But
yeah,
but you know that's the cool thing about our state. When you really look at Pennsylvania as a whole, you know, we're lucky we have, you know, darn close to 900,000 people that hunt every year. A lot,
yeah,
of people don't realize that, you know, you go next door to Ohio, and Ohio has 350,000 hunters. You know, we're almost, you know, triple what they have. And you know, when you get up in the country you're talking about, the amount of public land, and we're just so fortunate.
Yeah, over
state.
2 million acres of public land in northern Pennsylvania. Like, it's incredible.
Right.
I didn't realize how lucky I was until, for a while, I moved by Pittsburgh. And then I was like, wait, you can't just go hunt wherever? Like, because I was just so used to so much being open to the public that it was weird to me. And then that really, I realized how lucky I was to be able to have that and grateful for it. And it's, yeah, we're really lucky to be,
right,
able to have that in PA.
Now, is your East Meet West, is that your full-time job?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome.
Yep.
Awesome. So you've developed that career into something that you can make a living at in the hunting industry. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's been 2 years now of doing it on my own. When I say on my own, there's a lot of people that help me. It's just as far as working for myself, and it's been challenging but super fun at the same time. My background is I went to college for safety and environmental, and that's what I did in manufacturing for for the first 8-9 years until I transitioned into this. But I always had to do a lot of educational stuff, and I love education. Mm-hmm. So that's been kind of my platform is education side of things, not really entertainment, more of the education front. And I like doing that, and I'm relatively comfortable with talking in front of people, so that, that helps.
Yeah. You know, I kind of did it backwards personally. Like you, I started in the outdoor industry. I worked there for 30 years and then, you know, totally my own boss and, you know, traveling the country talking about turkey hunting. And, you know, when the turkey craze was new in a lot of places, and I started when I was 16, and then in my 50s, I said, man, I'm going to, you know, settle down a little bit and come work for the state agency. And it's been awesome because, you know, without state agencies, without wildlife, there's no future. And
100%.
You know, we're always trying to do the best, and obviously satisfying everybody always isn't possible, but we do the best possible job that we can. And the bottom line is we listen to everybody. Let's talk about TAC real quick, where we're at, the Total Archery Challenge. You know, when you look at it and when you look down this row and there's thousands of people down there shooting their bows, you know, how does this help hunters get ready for bow season?
Well, so I started coming to TAC, I think it was either the first or second year, maybe 2015, somewhere around there. And when there was like 10 booths, maybe 8 that were here, I worked for an archery shop at the time, and we had a booth here. And I started shooting the event, and I was like, man, some of these shots aren't realistic. They're super far, and like, how is this relatable? But what that taught me was when you practice something that's harder than what you actually have in a hunting scenario, it makes it so much easier when you have a 15-yard shot, when you're shooting at 60, 70, 80 yards. And because every little detail that you mess up, your arrow's going to go a lot further away at longer distances. So these events help you work under pressure. You have your buddies that are there with you, you know, giving you crap. And it just really helps find those holes in your game. And then when you go back home, you start working on it. And that's what I said at the beginning of when I come here, it's like, okay, all right, I need to make sure my third axis is on, because when I'm shooting downhill, I'm shooting to the left or whatever it is, and start doing that. And then, yeah, when it comes to those hunting scenarios, it makes it easier because you're used to shooting.
Well, if you look at anything you do, if you play baseball and you want to hit 90-mile-an-hour fastballs, you can't practice at 60 miles an hour. You got to bow up, and that's the same thing here, you know. And it's really incredible. You see all age groups here too, you know, and lots of female participants, and just everybody's out here having fun.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, beginning in June. And, you know, what are some other ways that you think of that folks can do right now? I mean, we're 3 months from archery season here in Pennsylvania. Obviously, if you're going out west, it's a lot quicker.
Yeah.
But, you know, think about these next couple months and some of the things that you recommend to folks early season or getting ready.
So when it comes to the shooting side of it specifically, for me, one thing that I'd made the mistake in the past is I would just go out and shoot at known ranges in my yard and just, you know, shoot and shoot and shoot. And yeah, I'd get good at that. But a lot of times in hunting scenarios, you may range your trees ahead of time, especially if you're, you know, you're hunting out of a tree stand or you're hunting elevated and they come through, they're not always going to come on that specific trail or do something. So now I'll do a lot of times, I'll just take 3 arrows and I'll throw them in different spots in my yard and practice, you know, guessing ranges, confirming, practicing pin gap and trying to have realistic scenarios. And then as I get later in the summer, I'll set up a stand in my yard and shoot out of that, because shooting at an angle down is different at a deer than it is shooting flat. So it's trying to anticipate where your arrow is going to come out and making sure that you're able to put an ethical shot on. So practicing those types of things, those realistic scenarios, I think is super important and often overlooked, because it is fun to just, or it just becomes habit. You go out, you stand in the same spot, maybe, you know, 40 yards to your target, and you shoot a dozen arrows into it. And that's good. There's a time and place for that. But, you know, getting through the summer and starting to practice some of those realistic scenarios has helped me a lot.
I heard Randy Almer a long time ago talk about practice, and I kind of taken this on myself. You know, I shoot a lot in the summer, and then as we get closer to season, I'll take one arrow and, you know, known distance 30 or whatever it is, mm-hmm. and shoot one arrow, because that's the one that counts.
Yeah.
And it's amazing when you do that, how it helps your concentration, helps you hold and get that release. Because, you know, as well as I do, when a deer comes by, like, it has to be second nature most of the time.
Yeah. And I think that practicing at, like, what you just said there, shooting that one arrow that Randy Almer has said, like, that to me, shooting one good arrow is better than shooting 50 that is just you're just going through the motions on things. There's something to be said for muscle memory, but also just making sure every shot is perfect from that standpoint of
right.
of practicing perfect shooting every time. And I'd rather shoot 3 arrows, you know, before work in the morning than to just go out and knock out 50 and your arm's tired and you have poor form and you're not executing properly. I think that's a really good point.
So a good friend of mine, Danny Galvis, his son, I don't know if you know Corey Galvis at all.
I've talked to him messaging back and forth, but I've never met him.
I mean, Danny in the turkey world was like, I mean, he's still out there every day listening to turkeys. He's probably called some up this morning, and he's vowed not to shoot a turkey since the 80s. So he just talks to him, and I mean, but his sons have taken over. Like, you know, Corey is multi-time world champion with traditional stuff, and he told me, you know, he shot that giant a couple years ago in Tioga County, and he said he shoots an arrow every day of his life. Like, it's part of his being, part of his spirit.
Yeah.
You know, it could be 30 below zero and he goes out there and tries to sink one in, you know, and that's how you get good. I mean, it's 100%.
And doing the simple things well. And like you said, in the consistency side, I went to a long range shooting course for rifles last year. Buddy of mine that's in the SEAL teams and stuff, they put this on, and I was, you know, going there expecting to, you know, learn these fancy things about shooting, and it was all just doing the simple things. They do it so much that it just becomes second nature,
right.
The same thing with archery. It's doing those simple things really well, and
it's like anything we do in life. The more you do it, the better you get at it.
100%.
That's one thing about hunting, that when you think about, you know, one of the mistakes I made, you know, I grew up like you, it wasn't forced, but I was either going to be a hunter or do something else.
Yeah.
It was, but you know, I grew up in a hunting family, and you know, it's something that you want to do, and the more that you do it, and I've learned this, you know, the best deer hunters that I was ever in the woods with at one time in my life were my buddies from Alabama, and the reason is they can hunt from October till February, and they can hunt every day. At that time, they could kill a buck and 2 does a day. So they were shooting stuff, you know, and they were good at it. And the reason is they could read sign. They could figure out what those deer were going to eat different times of year, no matter where they went, because they knew what was going on. Plus those deer down there, you know, our deer experience a lot of pressure and are skittish. When you look across the country, PA bucks are tough.
Well,
deer in general. Alabama deer, the skittiest deer. I mean, they're just like, they're on pins and needles every time. And it's just, it's crazy. And, you know, when you think about summer too, you know, you're probably already have started your scouting for next year. I'm sure every time you go in the woods, you're scouting. But, you know, some of the things, what do you, in, you know, next couple months, June, July, August, where people can do, you know, if they have some free time to get out there and check around, some of the stuff that you might recommend.
Yeah, and honestly, summertime is my least favorite to be out because it's hot,
it's buggy, bugs,
there's spider webs everywhere,
snakes,
all that stuff. But I think there is a lot of value in it. And I spend most of my time scouting in March, April, and then even through turkey hunting. I use that a lot for deer hunting. But as you start getting into June, July, and August, for me, it's a lot of, there's 2 forms of scouting. It's the in-the-field stuff, but also stuff that you can do at home to be able to do so. So like when I go out in the springtime and I'm scouting and I'm finding spots and sign from last year before that green up comes, now in the summertime, I'm starting to put cameras out. I'm trying to figure out, one, did the deer that laid that sign down, did they make it through from last year? Am I getting out, scouting, seeing what things are looking like? As you start getting later into the summer, I'm going to start taking my binos out in August and looking to see if acorns are starting to come in the tree. How are the apples doing? Like some of those food sources that are going to start to roll around in early October. And so those are things that I'll do out in the woods. But like, especially with trail cameras, when in the summertime, they're not always in those places come fall. But what I've learned is they don't typically go as far as I used to think. It's just finding places that have shade, water, and they'll still use scrapes at that time. So I try to find scrapes that are located, you know, on north slopes that have some shade, maybe some conifer trees, some hemlock, things like that. And then also food. So in the form of the big woods is browse. So clear cuts, you know, blackberry briars that are coming up, some maple twigs, you know, something that's coming up that they're browsing on. And then, you know, spring seeps, doesn't have to be a pond or a river, but just something that has some water, have all those things that they need there. Those are good places for intel for me. And then at home, I'm spending a lot of time looking at maps of waypoints that I had dropped while I was out in the field in the spring, and then kind of putting together a game plan to look at, okay, so when the fall comes around, I'm not like, oh, what am I going to be doing?
Right.
Kind of have a plan to work towards that.
Yeah, and that's one thing we forget is humans, we are predator.
Yeah.
And we're the only one that can reason and figure something out. And that's, I mean, to me, like I'm sure you, that's all part of the hunt.
You know,
that's as, 'cause it builds that anticipation, and you know, you're trying to use what we, you know, what we have in our brains and try to figure out a situation. And when it all comes down to it, I mean, it pays off in big dividends. When you talked about something, you know, a lot of folks don't realize this, and I'm included. You know, I always thought I knew everything there was about oak trees, but there's so much when you think about oaks. And, you know, some people don't realize you can go out and find acorns early and see what, you know, when you look, do you look for certain oaks or?
Yeah. So, and it depends on the areas on what type of oaks will be there. But, you know, first and foremost, if I can find white oak trees, that's going to be the early season.
Right.
You know, that's the filet mignon of the deer woods. And when those are dropping, and then also red oaks, which seems like, you know, that's, if there's no white oaks, that's kind of seems to be primary, but you know, having those there, and then even, you know, chestnut oaks and some of those black oaks and some of those other trees there, which may not be their first choice, but as you start getting later in the season, if they're the ones that are left on the ground, that's when they seem to be coming to scoop those up. So I'm looking at all of those different things and trying to plan throughout the different seasons. So if you're hunting a spot, say you're hunting in October and you're not having any luck, and it's like, oh, what do I do come, you know, November, or maybe you went through November and you didn't fill a tag and you're coming into gun season and late season, like, what are you going to be doing? At that point, it's like, okay, I already have an idea. You know, I remember I found chestnut oaks in this area. Let me go check it. And then you go confirm with boots on the ground to be able to see, okay, they're there. I can see they're digging, they're feeding, and just trying to utilize some of those woodsmanship skills, because there is so much technology out there that's great. It helps for when you have short amount of time, but that doesn't replace being able to understand the woods and being out there and looking at those things. And that's something I take a lot of note of, and something I learned a lot from my dad that I've been lucky to have as a mentor in that. So
when you talk about, and I learned this year just from our foresters, you know, when a white oak drops, obviously they drop, you know, pretty early, you know, in October, and like you said, everything, turkeys, deer, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's filet mignon, but that white oak, as soon as it drops, starts to develop that root system because it's pushing a root down, where a red oak lays more dormant till the next year. That's why red oaks really generate every 2 years. But, you know, and once that root comes out so far, it's not as palatable to a whitetail.
Yeah, what's it called? Germinating?
I don't even know. I mean, that's way out of my probably.
Yeah, because you can see it when it starts to come out the bottom of the acorn,
and it's pretty fast that happens. Where a red oak lays till it starts rooting for quite a while, or germinating, however you want to see it. I should get Gustafson over here. He could give us a whole lesson on that stuff. But that's exactly, you know, you're spending that time in the woods. When you talk about late season, you know, that's a season that a lot of folks overlook, because it's tough, but late season can be real good, especially if you have the intel or you know that food source. You know, do you do any of the late season stuff here at home?
Well, actually last year, because I had a buck tag late, I did and it was the first time that, one, I had the time and I had a tag in my pocket that I put a lot of effort into it, and I was really surprised at how much you can have success doing that even in big timbered areas by being able to get in there and find those good food sources. But also they're a little bit, you know, they've been pressured for most of the year, so they might stick to cover a little bit. But if you can find, say, there's an oak flat on top and you got a side hill with some mountain laurel and stuff, maybe you got to go a little bit closer to where they're probably bedding at than directly sitting over the food. But you can, I mean, last year my dad, was one thing that he was doing was like, when he was going out in late season, he was like, okay, where was I finding sheds early on in previous years? You know, those are areas that the deer want to be at, and was finding really nice bucks in that late season time frame. And there's not as many people out in the woods at that time.
Right. And you talk about that. I remember years ago, I got to hunt in the best places in the country. I spent a lot of time in Kansas with a good friend of mine. And, you know, they found a buck sheds like 4 or 5 consecutive years, both halves, within 100-yard circle of each other. Like, he spent his time when that happened in that same area every year. And I'm sure, you know, you can use that intel, to, you know, I dang sure would have a stand hung in there, you know, for late season because they're spending a lot of time in there. I mean, absolutely. Let's talk about some other scouting tools, and you kind of hit on it, you know, your mapping apps and your trail cams. Anything, you know, you probably put out more trail cameras than most people, I would imagine. How many cameras do you run, or is that a secret?
No, 40.
Okay.
40 to 50 probably.
That's a full-time job in itself.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And they're spread out quite a bit through, you know, there'll be some in areas I'm hunting, and there'll be ones in what I call test areas where I'm just trying to see if there's a caliber of deer that I want to go in, and also seeing what pressure's looking like. So I'll have them and I just let them soak. I really don't use trail cameras much for intel of that season. I'm a very data-driven person and see historical trends. So at the end of the year, pull my SD cards, put them on my computer, and I'll go through and I'll look at dates. You know, when was I getting daylight activity? Correlate that to the weather, and I have these things mapped out because I tend to see historical trends of places that will become good. So I use trail cameras a lot for that, for next year and the year after, more so than.
Like, I'm going to be in the woods October 28th, because especially if there's a cold front. Because,
Or like if I say there's like, okay, 2 years in a row, I've had activity between October 26th and 28th here. Well, really, I'm going to look at what the weather is. And sometime in that 5 to 7 day window, I want to be there.
Right.
And do that. And that's been really helpful for me to be able to do that. And especially, you know, right now with working for myself, I'm very lucky that I can spend more time in the woods. But when I didn't have that ability, that was super helpful. Sure. Like, okay, if I'm planning days off of work or anything like that to be able to get out, that was, something I used.
So from your data sets over the, you know, your pad, if you had to pick, you know, 4 or 5 days to take off work in archery season, you know, in, you obviously can't predict the weather. We're not in control of that. What advice would you give to folks out there?
I would say if there's a cold front around October 25th, somewhere in that range, or even a few days on the front end, a few days on the back end, that is a really good time. You find a good scrape that it can be really good. As far as a full on, you know, rutting type action, it seems like from November 7th through 11th in that period, I really like it. And then the biggest of the big deer, it can be lonely days in the woods without a lot of movement, but that November 14th to 16th, 17th, in that range, right at the very end of the season, is really good. But it can question your mental state sometimes because you don't see a lot during that time period, but some of the biggest of the big are out roaming looking for some of those last does.
They're smart enough and been around enough seasons, they know there's something still happening. And it's you see that in turkeys too, you know. At the end of spring turkey season, a lot more of those gobblers have been around a few years, or, you know, they're still searching for hens, and the 2-year-olds are like worn out because they've been like
running around
high school kids chasing looking for dates, and that it makes total sense. That's great information. And, you know, one of the mistakes I think a lot of folks make with trail cameras, because look where it's come. I mean, I remember the first ones with 35 millimeters. You take it and get it developed. You're probably too young to remember.
I that's my first trail camera I had was 35 millimeter, and my dad would take me to CVS.
Yes, and you couldn't wait to get it.
You'd pay a little extra for the 1 hour development.
But, you know, nowadays your phone buzzes and you got a picture. And I see and hear and talk to people that even my good friends are like, I'm not getting anything on camera. I'm not going hunting. And it drives me crazy. Mm-hmm. Still hunting. They're letting that trail camera, you know, like you said earlier, it doesn't take place. It doesn't take any place of boots on the ground or time in a tree or whatever. I think that's a huge mistake. I don't know what your feelings are.
Yeah. And I will say, like, even for myself, when I do run cell cameras, a lot of the areas I hunt, I don't have good enough cell service to do that. But it can be a good thing and it can be a bad thing, because you start living by those cameras. And that's not – I've seen so many people, like you said, do that exact same thing. And I've come into the trap at times, too, of like, oh, you know. But by the time you get that intel, it's already done.
Right.
It's already – too late. But what I do like about it is you don't have the intrusion as far as being able to get into the woods, and, you know, besides changing out batteries, really, but to get that information. But I would really urge people, from my experience, to to not rely so much on them. Use them as a tool, but don't rely on them of where you're going to to go and hunt. Like that's and one thing that as far as like the real-time data that I will use is, okay, you start seeing some action, some things heating up, specifically around the rut. And it's like, okay, that area is starting to get hot. Now it's like, okay, that okay, there might be some rutting action in there to take advantage of. But as far as, you're waiting for a big buck to show up, I rarely see in big wood settings deer on any sort of patterns that are daily. Like, it's not... You're just chasing your tail a lot.
Right. Especially as you get towards the rut, and a hot doe might walk by, and a deer you don't even know is around.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of big deer shot because of luck, too. I mean, it's... Probably the majority of them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're exactly right there. But, no, the cell camera thing, like, especially when I talk to newer hunters, a lot of questions I get, you know, what cell camera should I buy? And it's like... Okay, hold on a second. Like, yeah, cameras can be a great tool, but there's a lot of things that you can learn of being out there, just going out and observing and seeing things before, you know, cameras are they're not an end all be all.
So the more you're talking, you have your science, the way that you have this down to a science, and I'm sure that you're also open minded that you learn every single day of your life, and that's important too. Like, when we think we know it all, they're going to humble us.
Oh, every time. Yeah. I have a way that I like to do things, but is by no means is it right. It's just what I like to do and what I've found that works for me. But every year I'm learning so much, and there's so many times that, like, I'll get messages from people during hunting season, like, oh, I'm doing this, I'm struggling, I'm not seeing this. What should I do? I'm like, keep doing it.
Right.
Like, it just takes time. It takes time to learn it and be able to adjust and make, you know, movements and stuff. And, you know, I hunt, I don't, at this point, I don't hang any fixed stand, so I'm always moving as I'm going through. And that doesn't mean I won't hunt the same tree 3, 4, 5 days in a row, but I'm always making micro adjustments to get and seeing what the woods are showing me to be able to move.
Do you find the first time? Let's talk about that a little bit, because especially in the big woods, and we hear this all the time. You know, there's no deer there, and there was a time. When I was a kid, the deer herd was crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd see 20 or 30 deer in a group in gun season and one spike following them up. And
yeah.
I mean, you hunted all season to try to find the legal spike. And times have changed. I mean, we're in the greatest times ever, in my opinion, as far as our deer.
We were just talking about that last night. I was like, this is probably, like, we'll probably look back. And hopefully it continues just to go that way. But it was just like, this is probably some of the best times that we've had, at least in the areas that I hunt. Deer numbers, yes, are they lower than in farm country? Yes, but they've gotten to a point where there's less days that I'm not seeing deer. But even when you don't, it doesn't mean they weren't 50 yards from you and you couldn't see them.
Right.
And that's but it's also a good buck to doe ratio where they have really good food too, and the forest management has been great. I've loved seeing all the different. The generations of cuts and everything that have come through there to be able to help regenerate, and the browse, and these deer are healthier, the bodies are bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And then also what I was saying with the buck to doe ratio, it makes the rut more exciting because those deer have to travel a little bit versus areas that have, a ridiculous amount of does. Those bucks don't need to go very far,
I mean, it's when you look at it, it's all common sense, know, and it's when, you get up in that big woods, no, there's not a deer behind every tree. There's certain things you look for, and that kind of blends us into the next thing. Like, when you're out here, even when we get close to deer season, is there certain terrains that you favor? I mean, obviously the food stuff we talked about earlier, is there any kind of vegetation cover, that you really try to key in on or you think is key to your success?
I like when I'm looking at a map and I'm looking at an aerial view of an area to see somewhere I want to go to, I want to see as much color as I can. So as much diversity as I possibly can, because to me, that means that there's going to be food, there's going to be cover, and there's going to be edges. And deer like to work edges of things. But, if you go to areas that are all just big mature forests and oak trees, well, if there's not an acorn crop, those deer may not be there.
Right.
But if you go to an area that has some oak trees and mature woods, and then they've got a 3-year-old clear cut over here, and they have a 15-year-old clear cut over here, and then you have conifers wrapping around the side hill, and you've got all these different things. Okay, there's no acorns, not a big deal. I've got all these blackberry briars, and I've got all this other stuff that I can feed on and browse, and so I want areas with diversity in vegetation, mm-hmm. more so than even the specific vegetation type, is just diversity right. in that. And now when I can combine that with different terrain that butts up against that, that creates funnels for the deer to go through. Now they can go other places, but something that's just going to, if you know, your deer walking through the woods and you're looking through, it's like, okay, that seems like the path mm-hmm. to be able to,
you get that gut feeling
to be able to walk. And I do, for the most part, I'll look at a map and I'll look at what are the prevailing winds for that area and try to be on the leeward side. So the side that the wind is blowing to, because it gives them that advantage, especially in hill country, of you have the daytime thermals that are coming up and then you got the predominant wind that's blowing over, and it kind of gives them a safe path mm-hmm. where they're being able to smell around. So they tend to be on that side a lot. But to caveat that, cover to me is one of the most important things. So if you have a wide open hillside on the leeward side, but the other side's got mountain laurel and it's got some briars and some brushy patches, I'm going to go on that windward side, because it just seems like to me, especially with mature deer, that they favor that cover in the places that I like to hunt.
That's how they got mature.
That's how they got.
They stayed away from us.
That's exactly right. So to me, it's like finding those places and then just walking them. You know, it starts with the e-scouting at home and finding those places and then just walking them. And I start with just a very high level. I have points of interest that I want to go to, and I'll walk through and let the sign kind of dictate my mm-hmm. my travel route. And then after I see things that I like, the next time I'll go in there, I might, you know, grid it a little bit more and try to get the whole picture of what's going on. Mm-hmm. But I will say, like, if someone that's not experienced with scouting places like that, the best place to start is by walking creek bottoms, because the sign is, you can see the tracks better because it's usually softer down there. You can see tracks, you can see trails, and then work your way out from there.
Let's talk about that, because one of the biggest mistakes that I think I made early in my career was seeing all that sign in creek bottoms, you know, especially in the bottom of a bowl or something, mm-hmm. and like, I got to have a stand here. Well, as soon as I put that stand there, the wind in those creek bottoms, you just get a non-consistent wind
yep.
a lot of times. And it's sometimes you can spend a lot of time in there letting deer know you're around. I mean, if you're not, that wind is so crucial, but it's also so tough in our state. I mean, consistent, you know, like you said, thermals and everything like that, but a constant southwest wind isn't always southwest in
no.
Pennsylvania. It's
no.
not like Iowa where
it rarely
it's
is.
Flat. Right, right. And that's another thing you probably pay attention to is like, okay, the predominant wind is coming from north, northwest. You get in there and it's totally backwards. I mean,
yeah.
I've had that happen a bunch to myself, and I'm sure you've seen the same all over the place, especially in the bigger woods where you're from.
Yeah, and so with those bottoms, to me, if I'm going to hunt a bottom, it's got to be wide enough. You get certain narrow bottoms, you got that wind and the thermal, everything's interacting, is creating that swirling effect that you're talking about. Now, if you get a place that has a little bit of a wider bottom that goes up, and if you set up like right on the water, sometimes if that body of water is big enough, it'll pull your thermals down. I actually shot my last two deer in PA sitting right on the water.
Oh, okay.
I climb up a tree right on it, because you can walk 10 yards out and you'll have swirling and everything going on, but on that water, it has to be a calm day,
mm-hmm.
but it just pulls down through mm-hmm. and helps with you there. But to go back to what you're saying with the swirling aspect of it, that's where you find that sign. That might be a good spot to put a camera and kind of see what's going on there. But to find that consistent wind, because you can find the best spot in the world, but if you can't beat their nose, which you can't,
right?
it's you're you have done. To find a spot that you can go. So I'll walk those trails out and try to see where they go to and have a more favorable
right.
spot to be able to hunt.
So, you know, and this one's hard to talk about. I mean, pressure. Let's talk about pressure. Our deer get an exorbitant amount of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure one of your tactics is to get away from pressure. Like, you're mm-hmm. the only person in there, I would imagine. I
yep.
mean, but pressure does so much to deer movement that we don't realize. I mean, I watch it in a little microcosm at my house, where once bow season starts, the neighbor starts doing this, you start seeing less deer. They're still there.
Yeah.
They're just not being visible like they were, and they're staying away from folks.
Yep.
And in our state, we see that so much. It's not that the deer aren't there. They're, like you said earlier, it could be 50 yards. They're learning how to stay away from
us. Oh, they're learning to hold tight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if they're if that's evolving or I'm just noticing it, but they are 100%, not 100%, but they're a lot of times holding tight, and they'll let you walk right past until you stop. And then it's like sometimes they'll
let
get
you
up
know,
and,
yeah.
And go off. But what I with areas with pressure, I've for a long time I was just trying to completely avoid it, get as far in as I could and get away from it. But what I've learned is you can utilize that pressure to your advantage. And even in places that are heavily hunted, there's always those safe zones where those deer will feel safe,
right,
and can go to. And you know, there was an area I was hunting last year that was pretty heavily hunted, and I never saw another person there because I found one of those spots where it was just like people weren't there, and there was really good action in there and some really good intel to be able to learn from. And then another place that I had that where I had a camera sitting there, I just left it all year, and when I went back and checked it, I was like, holy cow, there was a deer in daylight there the whole first 2 weeks of November, and I know there was a lot of people mm-hmm. hunting in the area, but just not at that specific
right.
spot. So it's when you're hunting areas with pressure, it's just trying to find where the people aren't. And
well, it's like Corey's buck. I mean, in Tioga State Forest, I mean, he told everybody where he shot it, and he also knew that there was a lot of people in there and people that knew about that deer, and he was, you know, you kind of get attached to something like that once you find it. And,
yeah.
and, you know, he just was at work or whatever and saw this, you know, looked up, saw that, hey, there's some red oaks that are dropping real hard. There's lots of deer sign. And he goes, I got to get in there when the wind's right. And it just happened. You know?
Yeah.
And it was an area that lots of people, you know, had been through. But
yeah.
that deer felt safe there, you know. And, you know, he talked about a lot of aspects. And you know, I heard you say slopes. Is there any particular slopes that you prefer or do you think deer prefer when you look in that big country?
Well, I guess to me, as far as the different slopes, I struggle with saying, you know, the top third of the hill or the middle or the bottom, because it really depends on what the food is doing there, but they tend to like the upper kind of third, but I like being the first bench down.
Right. That's been an old tale for a long time.
Yeah.
It's old timers too.
But at the same time, I've also learned that sitting right on that flat bench, you can miss things because deer will skirt just over the edge. So I like to, if I'm going to set up to where I can shoot, you know, down over the, mm-hmm. the bottom side and to, you know, sometimes those benches will have scrapes on it, but I also want to take advantage of what's skirt down. You might have the does and the young bucks that'll go across that bench. And if that's what you're looking for, that's great. But a lot of times the mature deer will skirt that just downwind of it. They can smell that scrape and never have to walk in front of it, never have to walk in front of your camera,
right.
and they're still there to be able to use it.
Turkeys, a lot of times, big old gobblers are the same way. You know, you obviously want to try to get uphill or same level, but you get that bench and you sit back there and you call him and he's right over here gobbling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a reason he's not coming up there, because he's probably got, you know, longer spurs.
Yeah.
And he probably knows that he's over there drumming, that hen should come over there to him. And the last time he walked up over there, someone sent a load of sixes over top of his head. And,
yeah.
you know, something's not, and that happens all the time with turkeys too.
Yeah.
I used to sit back there and like, oh, this is great. Now I've learned, like, I'm going to get over where I can see over a little bit just in case he wants to just show off a little down over this hill.
Well, it's funny you say that about turkey. So this year I was hunting. There was this bird I knew was a big old bird. I knew where he was roosting at a lot of times. I would get close to him, and that bird was so smart, and I did not kill him, but he would wait. I mean, he didn't fly down until 8 o'clock in the morning, until every hen was down, and he'd drop right down in the middle of them, and then he'd shut up. And it was like, I mean, I spent a whole week trying to get this bird.
We all went to high school with that guy that could go out and you know, he'd just stand there and all the girls would flock to him.
Yeah.
And we'd be like, how's this happening?
You
know, and that's one of those gobblers. And he was smart enough that he's not going to come out of there early because he knows. And if they don't show up that day, he's not going to fall for your tricks.
Yeah, I mean, no. Just,
there's turkeys out there like that.
Yeah, he was laughing at me. I know that.
here's the good thing. He'll be there next year.
Yeah.
God willing.
Yeah.
So when you look at scouting, I mean, and even shooting, you need practicing. You know, tons of people stop practicing when season comes in. And I think it's practicing. You should shoot a couple hours a day during season when mm-hmm. you can. I mean, even if you got to turn the lights on and shoot a spot at 20 yards, whatever.
Yep.
Just to muscle memory. But talk about scouting through the season, because we get in, so involved and entrenched of time in that stand, and,
yep.
and I'm sure that and, you know, you being a mobile hunter, we'll talk about that setup too, because it's something that I've, you know, just catching on like wildfire.
Yeah,
and I'm sure it's helped increase your odds,
yeah,
tremendously.
But yeah, scouting in the season for you can do as much. I do a lot of postseason, as I said, or spring scouting and into the summer, and that's all really good. But nothing replaces what is actually happening right now. So when I'm out hunting, you know, I say that in quotations, that air quotes, that a lot of my time isn't actually spent in the tree. It's trying to find that sign and make sure I'm in the game, because sometimes sitting in the tree, if you're not in the right spot, not that you're wasting time, because it's great to be out there no matter what, but I want to put my odds in my favor, right, when I can. So I'll spend way more time on the ground scouting, maybe still hunting with my bow in my hand, kind of sneaking around and trying to find that sign throughout the season. And then when it gets to the rut, it's more so me, I'll sit in, you know, funnels and stuff and do less scouting, more right, actual hunting at that time. But throughout the other times, everything's changing so rapidly. Every week in October, you know, leaves are coming off the trees. So maybe a good bedding area isn't a good bedding area anymore, because it's kind of open
exposed now.
And that things are changing. Food sources, if there's an area with cherry trees, the black cherries are all scooped up, so they might not be feeding there. You know, some acorns might be scooped up now, and now they're moving here. Mm-hmm. So it's a constant trying to stay on that.
Stay on top of it.
You know, even if I, you know, I think about it when I go to out-of-state trips too. It's if I have 5 days to hunt, I might spend 3 days scouting.
I was just going to say that if you look at the Western style,
mm-hmm,
you spend way more time looking in glassing and trying to find things,
yeah,
before you actually go in there and try to hunt it. I mean,
yeah,
especially us going out west and never laid eyes on this place, we got to learn it fast. And
yep,
the best thing we can do is learn from a distance.
Yeah, and I think early on when I started doing that, I'm like, oh, I only have 5 days to be here. How am I supposed to do this? Well, I felt like I was better spent spending, you know, most of that time scouting until I found what I wanted to see and then hunt, because I was more in the game than just sitting in a tree, mm-hmm, for 5 days and hoping something comes by.
Right. When we talk about those big mountain bucks and hunting them for yourself, you know, it's such a challenge, but what is your biggest reward when you look at that?
To me, it's because it seems like there's very rarely that a season just things just all work out and it just happens the first time you go in. Very rarely does that happen. So to me, it's the reward of going through your hunting. You're in beautiful places and working extremely hard. Sometimes, you know, some of my places I'm hiking into are over a couple miles in. Sometimes they're not, but you're working really hard for it. And then when you finally get that moment, it's just, it's incredible. And I know how it's just so difficult. Every year it doesn't get any easier for me to shoot a buck there. It's just, anytime I think I'm doing well, and if I slack at all, I'm reminded really quick.
Sure.
So it's super rewarding when you do have that all come together.
And we face challenges too, because as birthdays happen and we get older, it makes it, I mean, things get tougher. It's just,
yeah,
it's a fact of life, and we get lazier, and, you know, sometimes those animals do the same thing as they get older, but they're always, you know, if every day we left our house or woke up and something was trying to get at us, whether it, you know, it's a natural predator or a, you know, a human, whatever it is, we'd figure out how to stay away from,
mm-hmm,
it. I mean, big time. Another thing I wanted to talk about, you know, it is something that that I've learned recently that we share is Lyme disease and ticks. And I think anything we can talk about is the good stuff, but I think this is something that folks really need to, you know, pay more attention to out there, because
yeah,
Pennsylvania is getting bad as far as ticks, and I think we still lead the country in Lyme cases. And I, you know, talk about some of the things that maybe people should look for that you think, and things they can do to help guard themselves when they hit the woods.
Yeah, and I was diagnosed, I think it was about 10 years ago now, but they think I might have had it for a few years before that. And honestly, I would always, you know, I had sprayed down some of my clothes, but what I lacked on was the discipline of reapplying. You know, sometimes at the beginning of the season, I would spray down my clothes, or I would go out summer scouting and not spray down, mm-hmm, my stuff, acting like, you know, the ticks decide they're going to take off because it's not hunting,
right,
season. And so right now I spray all my clothes down. I mean, even stuff that I'm, you know, if I'm doing yard work,
right,
around the house, like I'll have stuff sprayed down, and tucking your clothes into things. Like I remember when my dad would tell me tuck my pants into my socks, like to be able to have it, or if you have boots or something, to try to make sure places they can't crawl through it. But I spray my clothes, my base layers, my outer layers, my gloves, my boots, my socks with permethrin, and let it dry, and then be able to wear it. And then, you know, I think it's every 6 washes you're supposed to to reapply, or every couple months to be able to reapply it on there. But making sure that you're covering your bases is all the time, because you can get it as much, you can get it in the deep woods as you can in your yard.
Right.
And also just making sure that you do a thorough check. You know, when I'm out scouting, I like to wear light colored pants, because then I can see them easier if they are crawling on. But honestly, since I've been disciplined with spraying down my stuff, I don't see them on me much anymore.
Yeah, I got it about the same time in the same situation. It had lived in me for a while and I didn't know it. And mine actually affected, my blood pressure went through the roof, like 202 over 90 when they found it. I should have been stroking out, and they didn't know what was wrong. Didn't know what was wrong. Anyway, then got the Western blot and it showed up. But when I showed my doctor, I went to a Lyme specialist at this time. He's actually just passed away a year and a half ago. He was down towards Harrisburg area. I showed him my belt line because it just came out of turkey season when this was going on. And he goes, "Are those all tick bites?" I'm like, I've spent my life turkey hunting all over the country. Yeah, I get hundreds of ticks on me. And I, you know, this before, like you, I'd spray down once and I'm like, I'm good. And then you think you're immune to it, but I don't wish it on anybody. It can really, the best thing to do is get it early. But you got to pay attention to them out there, and that's one of the things I think is real important as we sit here today.
And what's crazy is everybody has different effects after Lyme. Like, there's very rarely two people that have the same impacts, but they're all negative.
Right.
And for me, it was they said because I didn't get it diagnosed for so long that it led to food allergies. So I can't eat gluten, I can't eat dairy anymore, and so all of these things. So now, you know, when I have those things, I get brain fog, I'm super tired, joint pain, all of that stuff. And that came from, you know, having Lyme and it
damn
destroying
tick.
My,
immune system.
It's like these little ticks, that are able to do it. And now, you know, and if you do get bit by a tick, you can send it in and get it tested to see if it has Lyme. And it, I think it's like 5 days, the turnaround on being able to know. It's highly recommend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doing that.
So pay attention to that. And you know, one other thing before, two more questions. One is, you know, if you have any advice to folks out there that you know, just want to step up the game and head to the big woods.
You know,
what would that, if you had a couple little things, and we talked about a ton of it, but I mean, most importance, I guess.
Honestly, it's not even a specific strategy or anything. It's go into it with the mindset that you're looking for to have that adventure side of it and enjoy it, because you're going to have to enjoy the process of, if you want to be successful at it, working really hard and doing that, but enjoy it, because it's cool to me to be able to go. And as far as you can see, you can hunt and you can explore and you can go do that. Like, I love every aspect of it. I like the scouting probably more than I do the actual hunting. A lot of times I love walking in the woods and getting out there. And if that's, you know, a lot of people that I find that do get into it, maybe have hunted more suburban type stuff or smaller parcels, enjoy it and get out there and put it, if you think you put in enough work, try to do a little more.
That's right. That's all you can do. But Bo, I really appreciate you coming on and helping us out, and we're proud to have you from be a fellow Pennsylvania boy. But you know, the other thing, and this is something that hit me hard in the last 5 years, and I just want to get, and there's no right answer to this or wrong answer, but when you think of the word conservation, it's a term I think is used very loosely a lot of times. But to you, what would your definition of conservation be?
That's a difficult question.
It's a reaction we get a lot, and because there's a lot of meaning to it, to everybody individually, but it's so important as we look to the future.
Yeah, to me, it's not looking at it as of today, tomorrow. It's looking at it at what's this going to look like 10 years down the road, what's it going to look like 15 years down the road, and kind of almost like as far as planning for that, for the next generation, and being able to have those experiences that we're having today, to make sure that those continue and hopefully get better.
That's awesome. Yeah, because we got to hand it off.
Yeah,
I mean, you look down here, I mean, everybody down here, their dads and moms probably shot archery, and you know, they handed off and burnt that passion. That's awesome. But you know, any last words to our folks out there in Pennsylvania?
No, I greatly appreciate the opportunity and being able to come on and talk to you,
absolutely,
Matt, and getting to meet you. So
yeah.
I really appreciate that.
What if
that.
Somebody wants to get a hold of you or check out your stuff? Let's talk about that. I mean, I'm sure your website, and
yeah,
if you want to share that with us.
Yeah, eastmeetswesthunt.com, or you type in my name, Beau Martonic, anywhere. I'm active on social media, the podcast, East Meets West Hunt, YouTube, Beau Martonic, and any of those places you can find me.
Okay. Yeah. I encourage everybody to check it out. There's
yeah.
lots of, you have a great podcast, lots of great information out there, and,
yeah.
and you know, let's stay in touch.
Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Appreciate
thank you, buddy.
It.
Yes, sir. Thank you.